Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Phia Tan Nguyen's new novel, The Committed, is the long-awaited follow-up to the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Sympathizer, which told the story of a communist double agent just after the Vietnam War. The new novel follows the nameless man of two minds as he arrives in Paris in the early 1980s with his blood brother Bon. The pair try to overcome their pasts and ensure their futures by engaging in capitalism in one of its purest forms, drug dealing. Phia Tan Nguyen was born in Vietnam, raised in America. He's also the author of the short story collection The Refugees, the nonfiction books Nothing Ever Dies and Race and Resistance. He is a professor of English, comparative literature, American studies, and ethnicity at the University of Southern California. Again, the new novel is The Committed, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Phia Tan Nguyen to the program this morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
At what point did you, as the author, know that you were going to continue this story, that this nameless man was going to go on in your literary mind?
You know, what happened was at the end of The Sympathizer, at the end of writing it, my agent asked me, what are you going to do next? It's like, okay, I have to write another book, I guess. And I thought it would make perfect sense to continue the story of The Sympathizer, not just for crassly commercial reasons, but for literary reasons. It's a spy novel. And in that genre of spy novels, it's perfectly acceptable to write sequels and series and trilogies. And I also felt that the character himself had taken on a life of his own, and that I was not done with him and he was not done with me. That in The Sympathizer, he is a communist spy who becomes disillusioned with communism. And that in itself is its own genre. Typically in the West, this person would then flee from communism and embrace capitalism and democracy and liberal individualism in some Western country like the United States. But I felt that that would not be the ending for my character. That would just participate in another kind of binary between communism and capitalism that he himself is rejecting. So I wanted to continue his story and find out what a revolutionary does whose revolution has failed him, but who hasn't given up on revolution altogether. And that's what happens in The Committed. We continue that part of his story.
He has come out of a re-education camp. Is it fair to say that there is more anger in the second book, evidenced just by the fact that you tend to use the F word a lot more? There seems to be more visceral anger, very philosophical often, but a tone that is deeper, that the effects of what happened in the first book are catching up to him.
That's interesting, because I thought I couldn't get any angrier than I was when I wrote The Sympathizer. But it's interesting to know that I tapped into yet another layer of visceral rage inside of me. I think that's possibly true. Writing The Committed was actually quite a different experience than writing The Sympathizer, because in writing The Sympathizer, no one knew who I was. So I had 2 years of just living in this dreamlike state of continuously writing, and it was wonderful. Whereas The Committed was much more interrupted, and so didn't feel as continuous. And perhaps that's why I can't quite put my finger on whether I felt more rage or not. But there certainly is rage in the book, I think, because he's tackling another part of his heritage that he didn't get to confront as much in The Sympathizer. In The Sympathizer, you know, he takes on Vietnamese communism and anti-communism, and he takes on American culture and the United States. And there's a lot to say in all those respects. But the French in that book got off fairly lightly, and the reason why that's important is the narrator is part French, part Vietnamese. His father is a French priest who molested this teenage girl who becomes the sympathizer's mother. And so in The Committed, he goes to Paris, to France in 1982, which is very deliberate on my part, that this would allow him to, you know, engage with French culture and also to be very as critical of the French as he was of the Americans in the first novel. And I think there is a lot of rage there. And I think, you know, because I inhabited his point of view in this book, in both books, he has a lot of issues with his father, who's refused to recognize him. And this is very crucial, because in French colonial culture, French fathers who recognize their Eurasian children allowed those children to become French citizens, to go to France and so on. This French priest obviously could not do that, would not do that. And so this son is cast out both from a family, but also from French culture itself. So he has a lot of rage. He's also been deeply damaged by all the events in The Sympathizer, including this re-education camp that you mentioned, where the novel concludes. So of course I channeled all of that and mix it in with my own feelings about French culture, which, the last thing to say here is that it's not pure rage. I actually love French culture. I spent a lot of time in France and in Paris. I'm taking French language classes. I'm easily seduced by French culture because I'm mentally colonized. But at the same time, I'm contradictorily also rather angry about how the French have basically, I think, gotten away with everything that they did in Indochina, their French colonies, because the French have forgotten about a lot of those things, and unfortunately, so has much of the rest of the world.
Viet Thanh Nguyen is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is The Committed. And yes, by mentioning the rage, I certainly don't want to discount the fact of how funny both books are, but especially this novel and the humor that is throughout. The idea of looking at the French and ultimately having the book take place almost entirely in Paris. That really allowed you to reflect on that because it's a full immersion for the character and for us, the reader.
Sure, absolutely. And what's not to love about Paris? I mean, it's a city that everybody has an opinion about, everybody has some kind of image about. And in writing this novel, I wanted to make sure that I undermined that image, that I would pull the plug on the City of Light. So it's not really a novel about the Paris of the tourist romantic fantasies about the Eiffel Tower and the Louvre and all that kind of stuff. It's really about the immigrant quarters of Paris. Because our narrator ends up, working in the worst Asian restaurant in Paris, in the 13th arrondissement in Little Asia, and connects that world with the world of elite white Paris because he lives with his aunt, and she's also mixed French and Vietnamese, but she's an editor and she hangs out with the left-wing socialist intellectual political crowd, but it turns out they're human beings. They like drugs as much as everybody else, and so our narrator deals hashish to them, and so he serves as the bridge between the high and the low cultures of Paris. And what I wanted to try to do there is, use Paris as a setting that many people are familiar with, but to show how even this city of light cannot be separated from the seamier sides of the world, whether it's drug dealing and drug consumption, or the fact that this drug dealing and drug consumption is completely tied to French colonial history, because in Indochina, one of the ways that the French financed their colonial operations was to grow opium and force the natives to buy it and to consume it. And so this is all very serious and tragic kind of stuff, but as you said, I try my best to be funny in this book because besides rage as a tool for pointing out people's failings and countries' failings, humor, satire is really hopefully very effective at pointing out the absurdities and hypocrisies that the powerful always have. And here, of course, the discrepancy, the hypocrisy and the absurdity is between these French ideals of democracy and liberty and equality and so on, and their contradiction when they are not applied in the colonies or with peoples of color in France.
You write midway through the novel, the French saw our shared past as a tragic happenstance of history, a romantic love story gone wrong, which was half correct, whereas I saw our past as a crime that they had committed, which was completely correct. And who are you going to believe, the rapist or the product of the rape, the civilized or the bastard? That is a very powerful statement, obviously, but also our narrator is the bastard.
Sure. That was his persona in The Sympathizer, that he's of mixed race descent and he's living in Vietnam and he gets racism from both directions. That the French, they're already racist in regards to the Indochinese, but they're also going to be racist towards these Eurasian offspring of the colonial relationship. And the Vietnamese people who are victims of racism, ironically, but not surprisingly, are themselves racist towards mixed race people within Vietnam. And I wanted to draw attention to that because I wanted to hold the Vietnamese responsible for what they have done as well. So, you know, it was crucial to put him at the middle of all of these kinds of conflicts. That whole idea of East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet, in fact, meets within him. And at the middle, he can then pivot constantly in a 360-degree circle and criticize everybody and every culture that he comes into contact with. And of course, he resents being called a bastard. In The Sympathizer, it's the one word, the one epithet that will set him off and drive him to new heights of rage and violence. Here in The Committed, he becomes more reconciled with that term. In fact, he calls himself, or is called, and he accepts it, the crazy bastard. There's another layer of his persona that becomes unveiled here. And he speaks in that voice. You know, he allows himself, unlike so many of us, to speak about the contradictions and hypocrisies. And you know, I think many, from my experience, many colonized or formerly colonized peoples, often restrain ourselves, especially when we are in the colonial environment. When we go to the metropole like France or the United States, we feel obligated to be quieter, to be grateful, you know, because we know we're in the presence of people and cultures that are more powerful than us. But in creating this character, I wanted someone who is not afraid of speaking out.
Also in the novel, you do get the occasional dig in at the French. You write, "We navigated through a quarter whose streets were narrower than the average French mind." You take a little nudge at the Mona Lisa. So you do get your chance, again, in humor, to get a few digs in, which is kind of fun, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he arrives very early in the novel in Paris of 1982 at Charles de Gaulle Airport, for example. And this is the moment for him to think, wow, this airport is named after one of the greatest Frenchmen in recent memory, a man who liberated the French from the Nazis at the same time as he continued to enslave us Vietnamese. And our narrator thinks this is contradiction, the perpetual body odor of humanity. And it's, you know, it's an aroma, that aroma of contradiction is something that we all learn how to live with, whether we happen to be Americans or Vietnamese who bathe daily or French who bathe less than daily.
Just the setup of this novel compared to the first one was fascinating to me because you have sections and me, myself, I, Vu. There is a structural difference in the book, in The Committed, compared to The Sympathizer, which is very much a shift, isn't it? And I guess an evolution.
Sure. You know, he's changed as a character. I couldn't write exactly the same novel. I mean, number one, it's not a spy novel because he's no longer a spy, but it's a crime novel. And I chose that because I still wanted to entertain readers. I love spy novels and crime novels. And one of the things that they must do is keep readers turning the pages. So there's a shift there just in terms of the type of novel that it is. But also he's a different character. And you know, one manifestation of that is the deeper level of rage that you detected. But another thing about him that's different is that he's been shattered by the experiences of the first novel. Both novels are first person confessional monologues. I have to be inside of him and I have to show the reader what he's feeling, not just in terms of what he's saying, but how he's saying it. And so one of the ways to convey that is to think about how words appear on the page, to think about the perspective that he's using. His way of looking at the world is fractured throughout the book. But ultimately, you know, one of the reasons why I did these things is because I was just trying to have fun. It's like writing the first novel was a lot of fun for me to unleash my voice through the voice of the sympathizer. And again, that's also what happens in The Committed. But at every moment in writing this second book, the question I was asking myself was, why not? If I feel like doing something, why can't I do it? For example, instead of using 12-point font, use 30-point font because I want to make a point. Or what if instead of using a 12-point font, I want to shrink the font down to something that's almost microscopic? Because again, I want to make a joke at that point. The inspiration here came from two places. One was poetry. I read a lot of poetry for both books simply because I wanted to absorb the intensity of language that I think many poets turn to, but also because poets break the rules of language all the time, including the way that words look on a page. And the other thing is, I have a 7-year-old son. We read a lot of children's literature together. It's been a great part of my life because I get to read a lot of stuff that didn't exist when I was growing up. And frankly, the state of children's literature today is, on the average, probably better than it was when I was growing up. And what's remarkable in looking at children's literature, what the writers and artists do, is that they don't have any rules. I can't see any rules. Like when I read like a lot of contemporary literary American fiction, I think I can see rules in operation that a lot of writers follow. But in children's literature, everything just goes out the window, and the creators do whatever they want. And my son gets such great joy out of it, and I do too. And I thought I want to absorb some of that spirit because I think there is in that childlike love of pure story and pure creativity and boundlessness, there's something that we rule-bound adults can learn from.
You mention the poets, but also philosophers play a large role for many of the characters in this novel. And you so often play with the idea of nothing and something. And just one line, I also believe that nothing was full of meaning, in short, that nothing was actually something. It's a very Seinfeldian reference, but it is also philosophically fascinating as you wrestle, as the narrator wrestles with it throughout, especially toward the end of the novel.
Now, this novel, in its genre aspect, is a crime thriller, but in another layer of it, I think of it as a thriller of ideas. I'm someone who gets thrilled by ideas and by philosophy, and I genuinely believe that readers can be thrilled by it too, even if they're not like philosophers or academics and so on. And so I have high expectations of my readers, and I believe that readers can rise to those expectations because I think all of us are grappling with ideas. I mean, part of the point that the novel makes is that in fact these powerful philosophies are not important just to people who are philosophers or who think about them in the academy, but the most powerful ideas have shaped and influenced all of us. I mean, when we talk about things like capitalism and communism, those have been inspired by philosophical concepts. And so that's partly what the book is wrestling with, is the importance of this person, this sympathizer, whose revolution has failed him, is now trying to rebuild himself psychologically and philosophically by rethinking all the ideas that have mattered to him. And these ideas, I think, are important not just to him, but to us. So the novel takes on these ideas about, colonialism and violence and revolution, things that are absolutely happening today in our world as much as they
Right.
were in the 1980s for our sympathizer. It's a learning experience for me as well. It's not like I go into these novels thinking I know exactly what the philosophy is and I'm just going to show it to the reader. I mean, my narrator is wrestling with these concepts of something and nothing. And at the end of The Sympathizer, the first novel, there's a whole joke about nothing that was not planned on my part. I mean, the momentum of the novel, the action and the ideas took me to that point where I understood what nothing meant in that novel. But I also felt at the end of that novel that I didn't understand everything about nothing either, and that somehow nothing would continue to play a role in the committed that I would need to explore through the motion of the plot and what it does to our narrator's thinking. And so the conclusion about nothing, I can't give it away here with you, but the conclusion about nothing at the end of the committed is meant to complement the nothing that is at the conclusion of the sympathizer, so that there is a duality of nothing and something in both these books that it takes both books to unfold.
The beauty of the language of the book and the fun that you have with it, it seems evident of when you start writing a sentence and you play with both hysteria and hysterectomy. I mean, that's great. That's just fantastic. Doesn't get better than that.
I when I do things like that, number one, it is fun, but when I do things like that, I wonder whether my poor translators in different languages will be able to make this work in their respective languages. That is kind of a problem. I try to do that both in the sympathizer and the committed. And I'm inspired a lot by, Lolita, that line in that novel that said, you can always count on a murderer for a fancy prose style. So there's a double layer there of meaning when it comes to the play with language.
The idea here is that as a reader, you close the book and you think you know the conclusion, yet you're just not 100% sure. You want that, I assume.
Well, sure. If we're talking about the end of the committed,
Correct.
it's meant to work as a conclusion to the novel, but it's also meant to open a door to a sequel. So, I mean, there's going to be a third and final installment of the Sympathizer trilogy, where he now finally gets to go back to the United States to make amends, to seek revenge, to tie up loose plot ends, and so on, but to hopefully make the final movement of his quest for knowledge about himself and his place in the world and his ideas about revolution. And it's going to be set in the United States of the mid to late 1980s, which is my time. I grew up during that time,
Right.
and that's a rich time. We're talking about Ronald Reagan and Star Wars and Iran-Contra, the crack epidemic. I mean, I hope I get to pull all of that stuff into the final novel.
There's ghosts that play a role in this, and so really your cast of characters is somewhat limitless because of the way you've set this up. They can be momentarily benched, but not permanently.
Well, that was one of the challenges in writing The Committed, is that our sympathizer is haunted by the ghosts of everyone he has killed or has been responsible in some way for their deaths. And as the novel progresses, that cast of ghosts grows larger and larger. So it becomes kind of a challenge to try to figure out how to include all of these poor people who are hovering above our narrator. They're lying on the ceiling looking down at him, for example. And so it was it's tragic, but hopefully kind of fun, because I have a morbid sense of humor. And I think that when I turn to someone like Shakespeare, for example, he doesn't have a problem putting ghosts into his work and making them interesting characters in their own right. So hopefully the ghost chorus of The Committed will only continue to grow in the final novel.
My final question to you is this idea, which I had never really thought of until I'd heard about, but I had never really thought of in such a way, in such a beautiful way that you tell it, of that of a blood brother, of someone that you commit yourself to. It rears its head throughout the two volumes.
Blood brothers, I've never had one myself, but I grew up in Vietnamese refugee culture that I felt was saturated with these notions of masculinity and brotherhood and belonging among men. I mean, Vietnamese culture is patriarchal, but one of the things that was striking was to see how young Vietnamese men are very romantic. They learn how to play the guitar, at least in my generation, and they sing love songs to their girlfriends and all of that. But it felt to me like their real hearts were always with their brothers, their blood brothers. You would go to pool halls and just be full of Vietnamese guys, and you go to cafes and they'd be full of Vietnamese guys without women. The idea of the gang was also really important to Vietnamese refugee culture. Like, I remember being in the second grade, the Vietnamese boys already had gangs. I mean, we weren't doing serious stuff, but you already had to make a choice about which brotherhood you were going to belong to. And this is an outcome of certain Vietnamese traditions, but also an outcome of the war and what it did to Vietnamese culture. And then finally, I'm a big fan of John Woo movies. I watched a lot of these in the 90s, and he made them in the 80s. But in his gangster dramas and police dramas, that idea of the blood brotherhood was always there, that men were bound together and that these relationships were much more important than what they had with women, and that these relationships were both bonds of love but also of antagonism. So, for example, the good cop and the bad guy, they might be opposed to each other, but they're also bound to each other because they recognize that they are more alike than not, and they are more alike than the rest of the society around them. And so I took all of those inspirations and I put it into this blood brotherhood in these two novels of our narrator, Bon, and Man, the third blood brother, who are bound by the decisions they made as kids in high school in Vietnam, swearing loyalty to each other, but of course being driven apart because Man and our narrator have also both become secret communists, while Bond is an ardent anti-communist, he doesn't know that his blood brothers have betrayed him. And of course, that makes a rich source of drama for both these books.
Your narrator also is a spy who it's okay to cry. He weeps a lot.
The sentimentalism is, I think, also part of this masculinity too. It's actually okay to weep for your
Right.
brothers. And in the second novel, in The Committed, again, he's been shattered by the events of the first novel, so he's no longer fully in control of himself. He's overwhelmed by these gusts of emotion that blow up from his past and from inside of him. And sometimes it's rage, and sometimes it's sorrow. And I just wanted to try to again convey how trauma wrecks us. Trauma leads us by our nose, and we can't control the emotions that swell up within us.
Are you a crier?
Not really. I think I can count the number of times I've cried on one hand. Up until recently, and I think being a father has really softened me, perhaps, and made me more emotional. Sometimes I will find myself tearing up, but maybe it's also because as a writer, I've had to develop a greater sense of empathy. I come from a very emotionally reticent family, and we come from a very emotionally reticent and stoic people. And so crying was never part of my life, and neither was expressing empathy or feeling for other people. And so for a large part of my life, I had to fake empathy. It's a good skill for teachers like me to have. So I went to, one of my friends who's a teacher who got great student evaluations, including that, she really felt for her students. And I said, "How do I fake this empathy that you're so good at expressing?" But as a writer, I think you can't fake empathy. That's a crucial tool for a writer, is to be able to feel for one's characters, to be able to feel for others. Even if you're a jerk in real life to people, in your writing, you can't be. In your writing, I think you have to feel for people.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, I thank you very much for being with us. Again, the name of the new novel is The Committed. It is published by Grove Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.